I want to say a few words of introduction, just so we get some of the terms right. As Dan said at supper, I've been working for the last 5.5 years in a strongly Islamic country, the country of Senegal, which is in West Africa, right here. I'm sorry, this is a mission map, so just ignore all the different colors of the countries, but at least so you know a little bit where things are. So I'm no expert in Islam, but I have been living among Muslim people for the last 5.5 years. Now, I try and get this straight. I hope that you know, but I'm just sort of reminding you. Muslim is the name for people who follow the way of Islam, the religion of Islam. And Islam is the Arabic word, but I mean, it's in all our languages now. In Arabic, it means submission to God. So this is the name of the religion. So we try and keep those things straight, at least. The Muslims I lived with are, for the most part, quite devout. Some more, some less, as we Christians are. As a matter of fact, probably considerably more than we are here in the U.S. As Dan said in his little advertisement for this session, Islam is growing, and I think we're all aware of that. We hear more and more as the years go by about Islamic people, Islamic fundamentalism, and all the changes that are taking place. It's a striking statistic. We're going to talk a little bit about Islam in the world, but I think one of the most striking things I've heard lately is that in West Germany, it may be the same in other countries, but I've heard it for West Germany, there are more Muslims in the mosque on Friday than there are Christians in the churches on Sunday. Now, it doesn't mean there are more Muslims than Christians, but obviously more of them go to their weekly worship.
In Germany?
In West Germany.
Well, because mm-hmm. there are more Turks
there. Uh-huh. There are a lot of Turks, but I mean, it says some there are not more Turks than there are German.
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
it's... But that's who the Muslims are, right, for the most part. Just as a way of introduction to and to kind of set the mood of how devout the Muslim people that I worked with are, I want to show you just the first about 1 minute of a video that was made on the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America's work in Senegal. And some of you may have already seen this. Don't be discouraged. It'll only be about 1 minute. And it starts in the capital city, Dakar. This will also be explained to you. And it simply shows thousands of men congregating to pray. I think it's important for us to remember that that's what Islam demands of people. We usually hear a lot more about holy wars and violent Muslims here and there. But really, what Islam demands is submission to God. And just to set the mood, I want to show you a little bit of this.
It is 2:00 in the afternoon in Dakar, the largest city in Senegal, Africa. The streets are filled with men who have come to pray. For most of them, this is one of 5 times each day that they will do so. This is the world of Senegal. It is 90% Muslim, less than 1% Christian, and it is here that the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America has chosen to do mission work. That work has gone on for 13 years now. To date, there has not been a single convert. Further.
I just especially wanted to show them praying. Will this bother you if I just leave it on? Because when I showed the video the other day, someone came up to me and said that they were really struck by how devout people are. And I think that sometimes we don't have that image in our head of millions, hundreds of millions of Muslim people praying regularly around the world. As I said, Islam means submission to the will of God. Now, can you think of other religions that talk about submission to the will of God? I mean, maybe we don't use those words, but obedience to God, dependence on God as our unique creator and sustainer. Does that sound familiar? It's, yes, many, many things I hope you're struck about Islam are similar to Christianity. The thing that makes somebody a Muslim is if they confess the main creed of the Islamic faith. Now, there's only half of it that I know, but this is the most commonly part repeated, and this is, of course, the part that we agree with. Again, in Arabic, because it's a very strongly Arabic religion, La ilaha illa Allah. You have these two L's, which simply means there is no God but God. Of course, the Arabic word for the one God is Allah, but it confuses the issue. I think if we talk about Allah, people sometimes wonder if it's the same God, but it's simply the Arabic word for God. So this is what Muslim people are confessing around the world. There is no other God. God is unique. And that's what Muhammad preached in the 7th century. I just wrote this down because I don't think it was long enough for you to hear there. But this is the phrase that gets repeated over and over and over as they pray, Allahu Akbar, God is great. God is great, God is great. That's what they say many times. And as you may know, Islam and Christianity have many similar roots. It's sometimes written that Islam is the youngest of the great religions of the world, which in a sense is true. Muslims would tend to disagree with that. They would say it's a very old religion, starting with Abraham. They are sons and daughters of Abraham. The story that's often told by Muslims is comparing the world to a caravan that started out across the desert. And they were traveling through the desert, and then they got to the first oasis. And that was Abraham, the prophet Abraham. And the Jews stopped there. Now, I'm sure Jews would not like this story at all, but we don't particularly like it either. But this is from the Muslim point of view. The Jews stopped there. They went a little further, and they came to another oasis, and that was Jesus. And Christians stopped there. But a few of them kept going on to eternal life, or to the real truth, and that was Islam. It's important that we hear that story from the point of view of Muslims to really understand how they view Christianity. We have not arrived as far as they have. They know the prophet Abraham. They also know the prophet, as they say, Jesus. So they say, why don't we accept the prophet Muhammad? As I say, what they especially repeat over and over is there is no God but God. This, the first time a Muslim person would hear this, if it's born into a Muslim family, is when the child is 8 days old, or 7 days old is really. If it's born on a Monday, then the next Monday is considered to be the eighth day. I think that's how it is in the Bible too. And that is the day on which the child is named. And this is what I saw in Senegal. I'd go regularly to naming ceremonies because, of course, my friends were always having children, lots and lots and lots of children. So I went to a lot of naming ceremonies. And it's quite moving. I mean, some of it is ritual that's strange to us. A goat is usually sacrificed, if at all possible. If the family has money at all, they would kill a goat to eat that day. And it would be the Islamic teacher who would be there to preside over this ceremony. The goat, its throat would be cut just as the name of the child was being said, and that's the first anyone would have heard of the name. The father would have been thinking about his name. In my part of Islam, I can only speak for Senegal, I don't know how it is in the Arab world, but where I am, the mother names the child the name that she feels like naming him or her, and the father names him a different name. So all people have two different names, and it usually happens that one is a little more well-known than the other, but usually the relatives of the mother would call the child by the mother's name, the relatives of the father would call it by the father's name. But anyway, the father gets to choose the name that the religious teacher will whisper in the baby's ear, and it's so nice. I mean, the teacher that comes whispers the name into the ear and then says, there is no God but God. So the child hears that from the time he or she is 8 days old and is named. Also, God in Islam has 99 beautiful names, they're called. And they're all listed here, which I won't read. I'm happy to tell you. But Muslims that I knew would often be carrying something like a rosary, that is 99 beads separated into three groups of 33, and they'd push them through. I don't know enough how the Catholic rosary works to be able to compare it. I only know the Islamic one. But they go through these 99 names as a sort of, as a remembrance of all that God is. And the names are, of course, adjectives. The compassionate, the merciful, the holy one, the peace, the faithful, the protector, and so on. And this is the view of God. They have a beautiful view of God, and I think have much to teach us in their devout worship of God. I want to go through some of the basic elements of what makes up the life of a Muslim person. Let me ask a question first. What is the central revelation in our faith? What to you is the central way in which God makes God's self known to us? What is the revelation for us of the Word of God?
Jesus
Christ. It's a person. In Islam, the central revelation of who God is the book. And the book is called, don't compare it to the Bible, because it has a much more central place in the life of Islam than the Bible. The way people write it down today is impossible for people like me to pronounce. Is anyone able to pronounce an Arabic Q? It's sort of a Quran, okay? But for us people who can't really do that, a way it's often transcribed simply as Quran. But if you can say kur, and then there's a glottal stop, an, that's good. That's more correct, far more correct. And you'll often see it written this way more and more nowadays. But this was the old way of writing it, and it's obviously much easier for Anglophones to say. Through most of the life of the religion of Islam, the Quran was never translated. It was written down, first of all, in Arabic, and that was the only language in which it could be recited. The word itself, Quran, means recitation. It's a very oral faith. People don't need so much to have it written and to read as we read are encouraged to read our Bible to learn more about God. The central thing is that it be recited, and it is regularly. In Senegal, again, as in most of West Africa, many, many young boys go to what we call Quranic school. Some of them go to this in addition to regular Western government schools. Some go instead. I think it's a little bit like Hebrew school, if anyone has been to Hebrew school or knows something about it. But it's in addition. You learn, it's all focused on learning the Quran in the original language, Arabic. Very little attention is paid to understanding the meaning of it. It's not translated. So these little children can recite enormously long passages of this book. And that in itself is a profession of faith, although they don't understand a word of it. It has that sort of mystical an importance for the Muslims that the Quran be recited in its true language. If it is translated, it's usually called something like the meaning of the Quran. You can't really go to the library, wherever you might go, and look for something that's called the Quran in English, because then it's not the Quran if it's in English. The Quran is only in Arabic. All you can have is the meaning of the Quran. Do you see the difference? So if you're interested in reading it, then you want to pick up something that's called something like that. Okay, in the Quran, we have we learn about the five pillars of Islam, which is humanity's duty if you belong to the Islamic faith. The first one, and some of you may know these, I'll review them sort of briefly. The first duty of every Muslim is to recite and to believe there is no God but God, and Muhammad is the prophet of God. That's the central creed. It's the first part of the Quran, and that's the central belief. The second pillar is the daily prayer. And this is what you saw a brief video of from Senegal. Muslims are commanded to pray five times a day,
And Friday especially, to go to, for the 2 o'clock prayer, to go to the mosque. Now, do any of you know Muslims in your community and sort of have participated, or I mean, have seen how they pray regularly? Is this all sort of far off knowledge? Okay. Well, if you go to a Muslim country, you'll see this. People stop whatever they're doing, and I'm sure Muslims that are in the United States have to manage somehow too also. I had a graduate student when I was at the University of Minnesota who had his desk just behind mine, and I'd just be sitting there studying. You know, all of us would be in our various desks. It was a big room for all the graduate students, and he would get down regularly on the floor by his desk and pray when it was time to pray. First one is very early in the morning. Of course, I never see that one because it's about 5 a.m. You know, it's sunrise, so that's not in my hour. I can't tell you much about that one. But I know that people have all prayed before I would roll out of bed. The next prayer of the day was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And the next prayer about 5. And the next prayer about sundown, 7, something like that, 6, 7, whatever time sundown is in that particular place. It's done by the sun. And the last prayer about 8:30, something like that. It kind of moves around as the sun goes up and down at different hours. And in Senegal, I would simply be visiting in somebody's house, for example. We'd be talking, and then they would hear the call to the prayer, because it's always announced from the mosque. The mosques all have loudspeakers. They'd hear the call to prayer, and well, right in the middle of the sentence, they'd say, well, they wouldn't even necessarily excuse themselves because it's so central that you pray. And they would move to another area. They would do the ritual washings, because prayer for Muslims is not just something they do with their lips or with their minds. It has to be with their whole bodies. So there's ritual washing that has been prescribed. They wash their hands. They wash their face. They wash their ears. That's always kind of a funny one. They wash their feet. If you don't have water, if there's no way you can get water, see, this is a desert religion, obviously, you can wash yourself with clean sand, but that's not preferred. So one of the ways, I'll just say this as a sidelight, that we encourage people to water regularly their trees, if they had planted trees in their yards for shade, was to have the place that they wash for their prayers near the tree, and then the tree would always be getting watered whenever anyone washed for prayer. And then they would pray, and the prayer is a very physical thing. It involves the gestures, it involves your whole body. There is this motion, there is actually getting down on the ground and touching your forehead to the ground, and then coming up. So you'll often see after prayer time, people have a circle of dust in the middle of their forehead. And I think it's sort of a nice reminder of who we are in relationship to God. So that prayer is one of the, is the second pillar of Islam. The third pillar of Islam, a very important thing that, that you need to do, is called sagat, or almsgiving. A certain percentage of what you earn, as in Christianity again, should be given for the poor. It's not prescribed, there's no definite sum. So, and I think again, that's sort of like Christianity, you give what you can. Often the number of 1/40th of everything that you have per year is thrown around. I don't know if that's practiced everywhere or how that is. But anyway, giving to the poor, giving to the widows, etc., giving for the mosque is one of your duties. The fourth pillar is the one that just is incredible for anyone who does not belong to this faith, I think. And you've probably heard of this. It's the month of fasting, or Ramadan. And during this month, their fast is a little different style than the fast we know from the Bible or in our culture. People fast. It's not usually quite like this. You are not allowed to eat or to drink anything from sundown to sunset. From sun up to sun down. So all day, anytime it's light, anytime it's bright enough to see the difference between a black thread and a white thread, so you can imagine how dark that is, you're not allowed to eat or drink. Well, now, if you've ever tried fasting, it's not that hard to go without food, but to go without water in this climate that I lived in is just, to me, phenomenal. I'll tell you, in the month, the Ramadan has been moving, when I first got there it was in June, and that was sort of moving up to May, April. I mean, it moves up because it's a lunar year, not a solar year. But at that time, where I lived, it gets up to 115 degrees nearly every day, and it's dry, which of course makes it a little more comfortable. But it makes you need to drink more. I mean, I would drink quarts and quarts and quarts during the day. But they did follow this order of Islam for 1 month. Most people, it's not 100%, but it's an amazingly high percentage, would not eat or drink from sunup to sundown. So of course they would wake up very early in the morning. Someone in the family, usually the mother, would wake everybody up and make sure that they've drunk plenty at about 5 a.m. just before sunrise. Then they can go back to sleep. And then all day, I mean, any work that you need to get done, believe me, you need to get it done in the morning. And then by afternoon, we're all kind of in bad shape. I mean, I was barely making it with drinking as much as I wanted. Nobody thinks about eating in that kind of weather. And then at sunset, people have a big feast and end up spending quite a bit of money for food usually during that month.
That's every day for a month?
Every day for a month. Mm-hmm. I've known Muslims in this country who have an even harder time when Ramadan takes place during the summer, because we have such long days in the summer. I mean, you've got to be up from 4 a.m. to 10 p.m., you know, and the days are long, but at least the weather isn't so miserable, so you can do a little better. But now, this year, it was roughly the month of April, I'd say, and next year it'll move up a little bit into March. So if you know any Muslims, think of them especially during that time, because they are certainly suffering. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, we had an AFS student from Morocco for 1 year, and he observed Ramadan the month of October the year he was there.
So that was a long time ago.
And he would watch that out the window for that sun to go down so that he could get something to drink. But he did it. He went out for wrestling and everything else, and I worried about him.
Yeah, you did.
But it was October, though, not summertime.
Uh-huh.
But he did it in this country.
Well, that's very interesting. Then you've lived through that.
From him.
Mm-hmm. I found that even my friends who were not very religious, you know, pretty secularized people, they didn't pray regularly. There are certainly people that don't. They still practiced Ramadan. I don't know what it was, the whole, sort of, part of it is social pressure. If everyone around you is fasting, well, you're not going to really drink either. I mean, even I wouldn't drink in front of anyone. I mean, outside, I'd kind of go in my room and, you know, get my water way back in my room. But they really did practice this regularly. It's simply a discipline. Islam is somewhat legalistic, but they say that it's a time for them to remember better God and their relationship to God, as we do if we ever fast. I mean, some Christians do and some don't. But we think of it as a way that we can forget all about things like eating and simply work on our relationship with God. And the fifth pillar, which all Muslims are required to do if they are in good health and have enough means, money or whatever, is to go on the pilgrimage to Mecca. And Mecca, as you know, is the place in Saudi Arabia, south of Saudi Arabia, where Islam started. And there's a holy, I don't know if they'd say a holy rock, but anyway, a rock that has become sort of a central thing, although of course it's very important to never worship anything but God. So they don't worship the rock, but they go around this rock called the Kaaba. You have nowadays about 1.5 million Muslims who go on this pilgrimage each year. Now I think it's kind of unfortunate sometimes that one of the rules or one of the things you strive for in your faith is something that costs a lot of money, because obviously a plane ticket is not cheap to get there. But in a way, it's really good for Islam, because it keeps up a community. Much more that we have nothing equivalent at all in the Christian faith. But there in Mecca, at the time of the pilgrimage, you've got Africans, you've got Asians, you've got Arabs, you've got Americans, especially Black Americans, there are quite a few. People from all around the world coming together and worshiping together. And it's a very remarkable thing, they say, for renewing people's faith and for keeping Islam as, well, it's got plenty of schisms, goodness knows, but keeping it as unified as it is. Another thing that they, I don't know the ritual well, obviously, but I do know that another part of this, it takes about 10 days when you're on the pilgrimage, and there's many places that you have to walk. There's certain kinds of dress that you have to wear, and on your last day, you kill a goat. And where I am, of course, this has always been really important to kill a goat on it. There's another feast day when you need to. So I especially heard about this year. If any of you have heard me talking about the refugees, when all the different governments were giving things, I mean, the U.S. of course gave sorghum, rice, oil, all the things we're good at giving. And Saudi Arabia sent over frozen goat carcasses, is what they called them. I guess there are so many millions slaughtered in Saudi Arabia at the time of the pilgrimage, they can't possibly eat them in Saudi Arabia, so they give them to all sorts of Muslim countries. So when we had these refugees, they gave thousands of goats, but already killed goats, frozen. So that was interesting. Many people, even in as poor an area as I was in, have gone on this pilgrimage. People really sacrifice for it. I'll never forget how astounded I was when I went out to a little sort of semi-nomadic village. Everybody lived in grass huts, you know, round sort of igloo-like grass huts. They were doing all right, but not great. There was an old man that came out, and it turned out that he had just come back from Mecca. Mecca is thousands of miles away. And it was, you never dreamed that anyone from that village would even go 100 miles down the road. I mean, it took from looking at it. But there he had just come back on the plane and everything from going there. And it was that he had a son who had been working in Central Africa and had made a lot of money in trade there. The first thing he had done when he got this money was to build a well for the village. So now that village had a well, so that was very nice. But the second thing, before constructing a house or buying his family better clothes or making sure that they had a more sure food supply or whatever, was sending his father to Mecca. That was the best thing that he could do, to thank his parents for all that they had done for him. When you come back from the pilgrimage, you're known as El Hajj if you're a man, or Hajja if you're a woman. And that's a great mark of respect, of course, because it really shows that you've gone the ultimate in the life of your faith. The Quran was recited by Muhammad. Now, Muhammad was born in 570 A.D., okay, just so you have an idea of about the time frame. We're talking 6th century A.D., six centuries after Christ. And he was a shepherd and a merchant, and he was out in the hills, and he was grabbed by the angel Gabriel, he says. He was horrified because he had been a very serious person, never wanted to see visions or anything like that. They say that he considered suicide. He was so upset by this strange thing that was happening to him with these visions and with this voice that he heard saying, recite this. So he would, this is how he tells it, okay? So God regularly would recite these things to him. He would memorize them, go back down off the mountain, go back down to his town, and tell them to people, and they would write it down in exactly the Arabic that he used. That's why it can't be changed. There's no question of a different translation or anything like that. This is simply something that Muhammad said. I mean, Muhammad recited, but it came straight from God. I'm not going to talk very much about his life, but it's very interesting if you ever feel like reading it. Because, you know, here he has this new revelation. And, of course, like most prophets, he was rejected. A few people followed him. They were persecuted. And finally, what they decided to do was leave Mecca, where they had been so persecuted, and go to another city nearby, always in Saudi Arabia. And they basically were like pilgrims, and they all emigrated to this other city of Medina. And that is a very central event. I can't quite understand why, but anyway, it's called the Hegira or the Hijra. And that happened in 622 AD. And the reason that that's important is because that year is taken as 0 year in the Muslim calendar. Muslims around the world, I mean, obviously our Western calendar, in which this year is 1990, is pretty popular around the world. Today is June 16th, 17th. But it's not universal. Muslims developed a calendar very early from that time on, and Muslim society was so highly developed through the Middle Ages that was the most widely used calendar for a while. It doesn't follow the years exactly like for us, spring would always come on March 21st. I mean, our, you know, with leap year and everything, they've adjusted it. We have some months that are 31 days, some that are 30, etc. For them, a year is 12 moons, and as you know, a moon is about 30 days, roughly. A few are 29. Sometimes it ends up being 29, but usually 30. So you take 12 of those, and you've only got 360 days. Well, actually, one of their years is about 10 days less than one of ours. But anyway, so now is about the year 1410 of the Muslim calendar. The other reason that this is important is that Islam, unlike Christianity, tends to equate God's will. If God is with us, we will be victorious. Christians, I think, well, we have the vision of Emmanuel, God with us, simply in the person of Jesus Christ. But that doesn't mean things will always go well for us. But with Islam, it's much more a question of our whole lives are religious, and if God is with us, we need to win. And so, as you know, this religion that started in the tiny town of Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia spread all over the world. They had a lot of military successes, first of all, but then people were converted by a great number of means, to the point where now Islam is truly a world religion. I want to talk just a little bit about that. Okay, now, if you know the answer to this question, just be quiet for a minute so everybody can think about it, because I'm sure some people know it. What is the country in the world where the most Muslims live? Okay, does anybody know?
India.
No, that's close. That's close.
Arabia?
No.
Germany?
No. No? Any other ideas? Where?
Pakistan
is second. No, that's further down. Not so big.
Soviet Union.
That's got a lot, too. That's a good suggestion. That's not it, but there are many, many millions of Muslims in the Soviet Union.
United States.
No, I don't know how many there are here. There aren't
that
many. I think there's a couple million here.
Senegal has 90%.
Yeah, but that country's only about 6 million, so that only makes about 5-some million there. Pakistan has about 70 million, but there's one country that way is more than any other country, and you would probably never guess it, unless you happen to have heard this question before. It's Indonesia. Indonesia has more than 100 million Muslims. The statistic I was just reading is 135 million Muslims. Twice as many as any other country, an enormous number of Muslims in Indonesia, which of course is very far from the starting place of Islam. Started here in Saudi Arabia, and through the centuries, I mean, there were people that went this way and down to here. I mean, actually, they went by boat across there. The religion started in the 7th century, basically, and already they say by the 8th and 9th centuries, it was spreading this way. The Islam that I know is what spread across here, and this mostly the Arabs conquered across here. And then once all these countries were Arabic, they started to come down across the Sahara. And in West Africa, many of these countries have Muslim majorities, or at least very strong minorities. It usually, it was none of them were by Arab conquests or anything like that. It was simply Arab traders that came down, and in the midst of all their trading, you know, these are bustling markets, you can imagine the typical African market if you know them. These Islamic traders would get down 5 times a day on their knees on the ground praying. They were not sent as missionaries, they were simply traders, but they would practice their faith. And it seems to be that, simply the example of them. They were often literate, and of course they were the only people that knew how to read and write. And by their example, Islam began to seem the sophisticated religion, and people gradually were converted to Islam through all these countries that are very far from the birthplace of Islam. So, I mean, of course, in Christianity, too, there's a long and exciting history of how Christianity spread throughout the world. Islam, I think it was less formal, usually simply by traders that were there. So Islam started in the 7th century, developed in the Middle East, and of course in other places, but it was especially that Islamic civilization in the Middle East that was very highly developed. Now, if you know something about European history, we were having what we call the Dark Ages in, you know, the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. Who knows anything that took place during those centuries? Europe was not flowering in its civilization during those centuries. But Islam was, the Middle East was. There were great centers of learning, there were universities, there were wonderful architecture going on. Philosophy was discussed. The Muslims were studying the Greek philosophers and, of course, the early philosophers of the Middle East and Mediterranean from the Christian era. They studied everyone they could find. It was a flowering civilization. So that's often known as the Golden Age of Islam. One of the splits you've probably heard about, this didn't affect me at all, was between Sunni Islam and Shiite Islam. Does that ring a bell? The Shiites, that schism happened near the beginning. It was one of the sons-in-law of Muhammad named Ali. The Shiites thought that the succession of the great caliph or the head of Islam should go to his sons, and the Sunnis wanted it to stay in the direct descendants of Muhammad. I think that's right. But anyway, it was simply that break that happened way back in the early 8th century, and has simply become very important in the 1970s, 80s, and probably 90s, because we have that very powerful Islamic government in the country of Iran, and of course splits across the Middle East as the Shiites become more powerful, especially with the support of Iran. I want to tell you a little bit about more about life in an Islamic country through the ages. When Islam controlled much of even southern, it tried to come up into southern Europe, but all across the Middle East and northern Africa, an important thing was how religious minorities would be treated in those countries. And the Quran had said that they should always be treated well and with respect, as long as they weren't like revolutionary and trying to overthrow the Muslims. So we're struck by the contrast. For example, in Christian Spain, during the Inquisition, when was that, 15th century, 16th? I'm so terrible at history. But anyway, at that time, when Jews were terribly persecuted in Christian Spain, they fled to Muslim countries for protection, because their rights were always respected in Muslim countries. And as we have to admit with great regret, were not respected in Christian countries. So have something to teach us there.
Is that still true today? Are they Jewish minorities still given their rights?
Gosh, I think so. I usually read it back in history, but if the Islamic government follows what it's supposed to do, and of course governments don't always. I mean, as we know, we don't always follow our Christian faith. But according to Muslim law, they should.
May I say something?
Mm-hmm.
When we were in Morocco visiting our AFS son 8 years ago, he took us to a Christian church, which was interdenominational. But he said, I cannot be seen taking you there or coming and getting you. I'll be 2 blocks away, because if they thought I had any connection to it at all, they would shun my mother. Mm-hmm. And not speak to her. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, was in the university, so he could get off and live his own life, but he wanted to protect her. But mm-hmm. We visited the church and enjoyed it. And there was the underground Christian work going on in the Muslim area there in Morocco. The missionaries had never claimed to be. They said they were teachers or this or that, but they were preaching Christianity in their homes there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you see the difference? I mean, if you are born Christian, or there are a lot of Jews in Morocco to this day, as a matter of fact, although slowly it seems that most of them tend to want to go to Israel. But through the centuries, I mean, through 13 centuries of Islamic rule in Morocco, the Jewish people remained. There just haven't been a lot of Christians there, so they didn't really have a chance to remain or not to remain. And they were protected. But for an Arab, or for a Muslim, to become a Christian, that would absolutely not be allowed. that is apostasy, and you're not allowed to do that. So if you're born a Christian or a Jew, you are protected as a Christian or Jew, but that does not give Muslims the right to become a Christian or a Jew. Another thing about Islamic civilization, and I didn't know this till I was reading it today, but I think it's quite interesting. In India, one of the most beautiful buildings in the world, the Taj Mahal, is Muslim. That is Islamic. I mean, it was built by Muslims. I really hadn't known that. But from the 16th century, Islamic architecture was really the leading architecture of most of the world. And, of course, was very strong in Malaysia and Indonesia. Today, there are 39 countries in the world where Muslims are more than 50% of the population. So it's not a religion that's limited to the Middle East and perhaps into Afghanistan. I mean, when we usually think of it, we think of maybe that band across North Africa, the Arabs, wherever they are, into Iran, up to Afghanistan, Pakistan, we certainly know that. But it's not just a few countries, it's 39 countries. And all the countries where I think that it's mostly where there's a Muslim majority have formed together what's called the Islamic Conference Organization, which I never paid any attention to until they decided that the meeting in 1991 is going to be held in Dakar, Senegal. And this is a big thing in little Dakar. Well, I mean, it's a pretty nice city for an African capital, but the amount of construction that's going on is just phenomenal. I mean, they've bought property that's like several square miles, and buildings are going up, and people are really revved up. Christians are a little nervous, but of course, in Senegal, we have a democracy, a secular democracy. Even if they belong to the Islamic Conference Organization, the government promises that Christians will always have their rights. Of course, the government is under pressure from Islamic fundamentalists, among other people. The government, the poor government of Senegal, has a lot of pressures on it right now. One is Islamic fundamentalism. Others are simply from unemployed youths who are also pushing for a change in government. But I think that will be very exciting for African Muslims who are feeling more and more that they haven't traditionally been recognized as they should, that the Islamic Conference Organization, the most powerful Islamic organization in the world, the money especially comes from the Arab countries who happen right now in the 70s, 80s, 90s to be very wealthy. That's the money that's spent, but they're supporting their African brothers and sisters. So it's really something that that we need to be aware of. Just a few other things that I want to read to remind us, and then we'll have lots of time for question and discussing. This is a book that's written by a journalist, and you know, usually the easiest things to read. He's no expert, that's for sure. It might not be the most sensitive treatment, but it's fun and easy to read. It's called Understanding Islam by Thomas Lippmann, and he's a journalist that lived a long time in the Middle East. And I think this paragraph, anyway, is very sensitive. A casual reader of the daily newspapers could be forgiven for thinking that the word Muslim is an adjective used to explain violent events in remote parts of the world that are otherwise incomprehensible. Muslim or Moslem, he writes here, it's the same thing. Muslim leftists make war in Lebanon. Muslim separatists rebel in the Philippines. Muslim insurgents fight the Soviet Union's troops in Afghanistan. Muslim militants hold hostages in Iran. Muslim extremists assassinate officials in Assyria. Muslim cultists make trouble in Nigeria. This journalistic shorthand, however, is misleading, unfair, and potentially dangerous. Because it goes on, it fosters the impression that Muslims are more violent. But you know how newspapers are. When things are peaceful and things are going well, you don't write about it. You don't write about the 1 billion Muslims who are going quietly about their daily work, praying regularly, farming, herding, getting married, having babies, just their life, and submitting to God's will. You don't read about that. And we do much too much tend to associate Muslims with violence. And as he says here, press accounts of the turmoil in El Salvador do not, for example, describe the right-wing hardliners as, Christian extremists, although they may claim to be Christians. I mean, we often qualify the religion of people when they exhibit behavior that is strange to us. So I think we need to be sensitive to that. Another book, I don't know if I'd recommend this to everyone, but it's very interesting, is called Bridges to Islam, A Christian Perspective on Folk Islam by Phil Parshall. And I guess, I don't know how much longer I should talk, but what he's trying to say and what more and more people are realizing is, what I've given you is sort of a treatment of Orthodox Islam, but what most ordinary people live is not just this. They don't just follow the rules, they do pray regularly, but they're looking for something more. They're looking for something much more mystical. They're looking for a relationship with God, and they are going to Islamic teachers who are working miracles. If any of you got to the Bible study today, we talked about that a little bit. They're looking for healing. They're looking for the blessing of God, the barakah, which is similar to the Hebrew word, if any of you know Hebrew. It's that blessing of God that they believe that certain Islamic teachers have the power to pray to God for, more than they themselves. And that's what strikes more in the life of the typical Muslim in your small village. I don't know how to convey that, but I think much as most of us, we don't worry about the theology of Christianity in general. That's not our problem. We're more concerned how God affects us in our daily lives. And that, of course, is what Muslims are after, too. I think I'll stop there and see if there are more comments and questions.
I was wondering, you mentioned the conquest of Africa. Was that to spread the religion, or was that for economic reasons, or what was the military?
Well, I think conquests are usually for economic reasons. I mean, even historians today are realizing that the Crusades, you know, the great holy wars of the Middle Ages, when the Christians said that they were going to the Middle East to spread Christianity, what they did was end up killing thousands of Christians in the Middle East and some Muslims at the same time. But it was a terrible war. Most historians today would say it was actually for economic gain. All the soldiers that went pillaged towns, they got everything that they wanted out of them, they came back. And it was really something for economic imperialism. I think that was more the case too. As the Arabs went across North Africa, they may have considered it a jihad. You certainly know that word, the word for holy war. But usually it's that's not enough of a reason. I mean, it's usually economic gain at the same time. I don't think they have as bad a history as Christians, actually, in terms of killing people to convert them. It's very strongly stated in the Quran, there is no compulsion in religion. You're not allowed to force somebody to convert.
Well, I know in southern Spain, they occupied for, I think, something like 700 years, and some of the buildings they put up there are just phenomenal.
The wonderful architecture, yeah.
And the mosques and things like that. Even the Jews, I think, put up in Toledo had a great synagogue, one of the great synagogues of the world. They, of course, Ferdinand and Isabella kicked them all out, both the Jews and the...
Uh-huh. Yes, that's the history in Christianity. How many of you have been in a mosque somewhere?
Well, an old mosque in Spain, we were there.
Mm-hmm. I suppose those old mosques aren't used much anymore.
A lot of those old mosques have been converted to Christian churches.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we don't have a lot of...
Muslims were...
I've seen them coming outside in Kenya.
Uh-huh. How about in the U.S.? Has anyone seen? We'll even start there. Does anyone know where a mosque is in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've got some big ones here. In Seattle, there is one?
San Francisco, there's plenty. And I was going to say, I've lived in Pakistan, and I think that prejudice and things like that are fairly universal. Because they didn't, in Pakistan, Christians were tolerated but didn't tend to prosper. But Hindus didn't do very well. Mm-hmm. In fact, I didn't hear or see anything at all in the other. There had been some before.
Mm-hmm. Had a very hard time. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, sort of. But another thing you didn't mention, you know, our conception of music and our tablature, the way that we write music with, you know, the bars, the scales, mm-hmm. staffs, all that stuff. That's Arab. Algebra. And there's also Arab.
I didn't realize musical notation. Yeah, it was Arabic. A very
I mean,
rich culture.
Before the Arabs, our scale, the scale, there was that scale didn't exist before. And it was brought north from Spain, and music as we know it is much still bears an influence.
Huh, that's interesting, because of course the people that I lived with didn't do any writing down of any music, you know, so that didn't come to me. The like things like the calendar were important because that's what is used to this day. But many of those things don't hit the ordinary person, but it's certainly part of the richness of our culture today.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in knowing the people that you got to know there, the friends, whoever you became acquainted with. Who do they think you are in terms of your purpose for being there, the organization you represent, and then also your personal faith and what that's all about?
Yeah. What I usually said was, I am sent here. I mean, they assumed that I was a Christian, so I don't have to explain that. I mean, they know at least what a Christian is. They don't know what we believe very well. There's a lot of distortion of Christianity and Islam. It's terrible. I mean, they always say, we know that you Christians believe in three gods because you have this Trinity thing. And you know who the Trinity is, or according to Islam, is the Father, the Son, and the Mother. The Virgin Mary is, they believe that we believe. That's who it is. I mean, these kind of distortions abound. So don't think if a Muslim is attacking you that you're, that, you know, at least figure out what, you can try and clarify your terms, first of all, what the Trinity is, but you'll never get very far of, like, how a Trinity relates to there being only one God. But anyway, they've heard of Christians, because, of course, part of the heritage of 90% of Muslim countries, they say, were under European colonial domination up till the time of World War II. So they've all been colonized. That was a great catastrophe for the Islamic world, colonization. And in Senegal, it meant that the French were there. Well, if you know something about colonization, you know that's not usually our best representative as who we as Europeans or Americans are. The most sensitive, kind, generous people were not usually those that went as, you know, rulers in the colonial government and early settlers. So it's not necessarily a great base on which to build, but they certainly knew about Christians. Some people just that I didn't have very close contact with just assumed that I was like Peace Corps, something like that, sent by the American government. Those people that I had time to explain to or were willing to listen, I would say that I was sent by Christian people who had heard that there was suffering in their country. And we are people that pray, like they are people that pray. Always stress that, because they really respect people who pray. And they often think that we don't pray, because they never see us praying, you know. You know, we're praying, you don't pray, you know. So I say that we're people that pray, and God tells us to serve the poor, and so people put their money together. It's not the government. People put their money together, sent it in, and sent someone like me to see if, you know, we can work together with you to improve your situation. Some people were often struck that we didn't bother to just go and help Christians, which they say would be the logical thing. You know, you could choose to only work where your own kind is, that is to say, in the African countries where there is a church. And as you may know, many African countries have very strong Lutheran churches, but Senegal is not one of them. Usually we work with a partner church, Madagascar, where Vivian was, I mean, very strong and dynamic church, and we work as partners, and that's the model of the Lutheran mission today, and I'm sure your mission, whatever your church is, I'm sure that's how they work as partner churches. But we decided to step out of just that world. It's very important. We continue to be partners with these churches that have been started and are so dynamic around the world. But we also want to be present in a Muslim government. So that's how I explain it usually to Americans, that we very consciously stated who we are, who we're sent by, what we believe, but not in anything that could be vaguely called proselytism. So, I mean, I would never say that my religion is better than yours or that you are believing something that's not true, but simply we are here because we care. We are here really because a lot of American Christians care because I was supported by the church. It's a long answer.
Really, there's no attempt to, on the part of the church to present them with the gospel message of Christianity.
Well, we'd like to, but it still seems very sensitive to us. I mean, we've been there 10 years, and that may seem like a long time to us Americans, where things happen really fast. But in Islamic countries, in Africa, I mean, things happen slowly. Change happens very slowly. In the village where I was, yeah, now missionaries have been there for almost 10 years. But that's not that long. And if we're living well and being accepted, I think as years go by, more and more people will grow up having Christians around and consider it more acceptable to talk more about religion. We'd like to, and certainly that's our hope and prayer. And as when I said that to somebody, that the time scale that's often talked about is 100 years or maybe 500 years that maybe there will be a Christian church. Somebody said, well, you never know how the Holy Spirit will move. Well, you don't. And there certainly are conversions in surprising places and times around the world, often through dreams and things that aren't really, you know, caused by someone. It's certainly the Spirit that's working. But no, we're just living there as a presence. I really worked in development. Yes.
Why did the Muslims take hostages?
I don't want it. She says, why do the Muslims take hostages? I think it doesn't reflect on their religion. I would very much doubt that their religion, practiced at its best, would take hostages. We can ask, why do Christians in Northern Ireland kill each other? Well, you know, you can't explain it through Christianity. And that's what I'd say. I'm not going to make an analysis of the Middle East. The people who are in that situation and have their political problems happen to be Muslims, it's true. But as I hope to say, I mean, those people are a very small representation of what Islam is today. It's political turmoil, and I guess I'd call it more ethnic conflicts.
There's nothing in their religion that calls for it.
No, absolutely not. And even the more I read about this term jihad, you know that term, don't you? I mean, it gets written about often, and it's usually translated as holy war. Many people tell me that what it actually means is struggle in the way of God, and that really the real jihad in our lives is the struggle within ourselves. As a matter of fact, there's a new book in the library under the new book section called Islam and World Peace or something like that, where a Muslim teacher is writing, and that's what he says basically. The struggle is between the goodness and the evil in ourselves, sort of, and as we get to our purer self, we find God, and that's the real jihad. That's the higher jihad. The lower jihad is to go out with guns and fight for God as you believe it. But no, very much it's not in their religion to do that. Now, who else did you?
Well, I'm going to shake on to you. The one about why the Muslims don't become Christian reminds me of what I think has happened in Mexico. You know, the Catholics went to Mexico and they, their membership grew in the church, the Catholic Church, like mad. But those people are not Catholics, and the Catholics are having problems now because they have not accepted the Catholic faith. They've gathered a lot of people into the church, but these people have not believed the Catholic faith. And so they're calling on other Christian missions in Mexico to help make Christians of the Catholic people. This is what I have understood. And so you have to be careful. You just can't. You just don't want to.
Okay. I think we have one time for. Thank you. Time for one more comment or question if it's short.
Thank you. I don't know if it's short. but the question's short. How do you think Islam affects the role of women, women's lives in these countries?
Well, it's not good. And if you were at my talk last night, I mean, there's polygamy, which is very much accepted. There is easy divorce for men simply by saying, I divorce you three times. there's all sorts of things. And I do find it as an institution very oppressive to women. And I guess I could go in longer. I mean, they say that at the time that it was started, 7th century Saudi Arabia, it was a great revolution of a liberation for women, that men could only take 4 wives rather than 30, and that they weren't allowed to, that women could get part of an inheritance. As I said last night also, one woman is worth half a man. 2 women equal 1 man in the inheritance laws. People would always tell me that to explain, you know, how this inheritance was going to be passed on. You have to understand, Jane, 2 women equals 1 man. I mean, things like that. But it was better than what was before, which is that women didn't get anything. Now at least they got half as much as a guy did.